I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Welcome to the Daily Stoic, where each day we read a short passage designed to help you cultivate the strength, insight, wisdom necessary for living the good life. Each one of these passages is based on the 2,000-year-old philosophy that has guided some of history's greatest men and women. For more, you can visit us at dailystoic.com. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic podcast. My guest this week is someone I'm really excited to talk to you about because actually about 2 weeks ago, she and I had a really long conversation on her podcast, pretty intense, and I would say it was a pretty intense conversation. And I would say I'm a pretty intense person, as I'm sure you've picked up from my writing and podcasts over the years. So it was awesome to chat. Danica Patrick is one of the all-time greats, one of the pioneers of women in professional racing. She is the most successful woman in the history of American open wheel racing. Personally, I know next to nothing about NASCAR or IndyCar racing or F1 or any of that. But there are these figures, you know, when someone is sort of so good that they transcend their sport. Danica is one of those people. Obviously, Lance Armstrong with biking was one of those people. Paul Rabel is one of those people who I had on the podcast recently. Sometimes, like, even if you don't know anything about the sport, you recognize greatness, or you recognize a maverick, or you recognize someone who just sort of is breaking new ground in a sport. And certainly Danica is that. I've seen her stuff everywhere, as have you. But I was really fascinated with her sort of philosophical inclinations. And I think you'll see in this conversation, not only do we go really deep, it's very clear that she's gone very deep and done a lot of work on herself, which of course is the purpose of philosophy, whether it's Stoicism or Buddhism or Christianity. The purpose of the work is internal. As Seneca says, the purpose of philosophy is to be a brush that scrubs off our own faults, not the faults of other people. And so it's very clear that, you know, she has spent the time sort of post-racing, and I've got to imagine this has been a lifelong journey of sort of looking inwards, working on herself. And I think that comes through. There's one thing I wanted to add, a little background in the interview that I think is interesting. I always like when something gets me like a quick bit of perspective, opens my eyes, makes me get something. You know, Plutarch talks about, and I think I quote this in Ego, he talks about how sometimes it's not words that teach you something, it's experience suddenly matching with the words. We live in times where this concept of privilege is talked about all the time, about the sort of intersection of different identities and experiences, and how, you know, sort of not everyone's going through the world as you are. And we don't need to get into any of that. And I promise you what I'm about to say is not political in any way. But anyways, I record most of these podcasts using a software called Zencastr. We don't do video on most of them just because it's sort of a pain and there's always bandwidth issues here in Texas. So it's just an audio only, and then you sort of log in and it records their track and you record your track. That's just sort of how it works. And so anyways, you know, I had my assistant send the link over to Danica's people, and then she pulled it up And then she said, hey, I'm here. And I said, hey, great to see you. And she said, so are we doing video or is this just audio? And I said, oh, it's just audio. She was like, oh, I didn't know. So I just got finished doing my hair and makeup. And it struck me how rude that had been of me and just how different the expectations of men and women are as far as media goes, as far as walking through the world. And of course, I know this intellectually, but sometimes something just hits you and you're like, oh man, right. Like I was assuming everyone was going through the world is my experience. And by that, I don't just mean as a man, I just mean as a writer, which no one really cares what you look like. And, you know, I get up, I take a shower in the morning and I go to work. And if I have to record a podcast, I have to record a podcast. That's not really, you know, the appearances don't matter because no one's going to criticize my appearance. And I don't have to worry about people reading into my appearance or making snarky comments online about my appearance. And go through this with my wife sometimes where it's like, oh, we're going. And so I'm ready to go. And then it doesn't, you know, as a man, you forget that different people have different obligations, self-imposed or societally imposed, that we're all carrying different loads, I guess is what I'm saying. And this struck me even more so because immediately after finishing the interview, I then had to do a video interview with a local news station. And so I went downstairs, got my hair wet from the sink, slightly brushed my hair and went back up. It took me 1 minute to get ready for an on-camera thing. So anyways, I'm not trying to shoehorn in stoicism to a contemporary debate, but my point is the purpose of the philosophy and the work is not to make you, not to harden your heart, but to open your heart, to open your eyes and help you understand other people's experience. And I feel proud of the fact that as I've studied philosophy, as I've gotten older, as I've done this work, one of the things that it has opened me up to is some of these insights. And so thank you to today's guest for helping make that possible, even though I'm sure that wasn't what she thought she would teach me in the podcast. Here we go. So anyways, here's my interview with Danica Patrick. It's a long one, almost an hour. Great conversation. You're going to love it. And I promise there's a bunch of good stuff in there, especially towards the end. And please check out Danica's stuff on her podcast, Pretty Intense. You can listen to her interview with me. It's a great one. And you can follow her on social media at Danica Patrick on both Twitter and Instagram. She's had a bunch of great guests. She's a fascinating person. And I think you're going to like this one. When we were talking last time, you used the word philosophize, which I love because it's not a word you hear very often, and it is a word that is central to Stoic philosophy. That they say, you know, to philosophize is to learn how to die, meaning essentially that the central question of philosophy is about our mortality, struggling with this scary thing. We touched on it a little bit when you and I were talking, but I wanted to maybe start there, maybe even do the whole episode on mortality, because it's a thing you don't get to talk about very much. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that it's something that is so, it's just not talked about that much. Mortality is something we all fear a lot. And I remember reading something recently that was talking about how, you know, if we didn't die, we would not have any purpose or reason for anything. Like nothing would be of value. Nothing would be important. Nothing would have urgency. Nothing, because you have all the time in the world. So it's actually what gives you life.
And it strikes me too, that in your profession, you know, there's obviously an element of danger in all sports, but every time you got in the car and raced around a track at, you know, hundreds of miles an hour, there was real danger there.
I mean, that's definitely part of it for sure. I mean, yeah, what can you say? You're driving 200 miles an hour with concrete walls around you. So it wasn't something that I thought a lot about. It wasn't something that I thought about it much more after I was done. And in fact, when I went and did the Indy 500 broadcast the year after I was done in 2019, I remember feeling like, thank God I'm not out there. Like I remember feeling like this is really crazy and dangerous and anything can happen. And, I sort of was able to sort of let the gravity and the danger of it sort of be felt at a deeper level than I was allowing myself while I was doing it, because it's, you know, not productive, not smart, not, you know, it's not going to make me feel better. But it kind of, you know, after I was done, I think there was an ability to let it really sink in. And I could feel that. I could sure feel that.
Yeah, there's a Hebrew prayer that says, the world is a narrow bridge. The important thing is to not be afraid. I've got to imagine that you can't drive a car 200 miles an hour if you're simultaneously afraid mm-hmm. of driving a car at 200 miles an hour.
I love visuals, so that's such a great visual to me. And what I'm seeing is that if it's a narrow bridge, when you accept the full gravity of the situation, the bridge gets higher. I tried to keep my bridge as close to the ground as possible so that I crash instead of die, which is, funny little analogy.
No, because I was watching a YouTube video and it's just titled Danica Patrick Crashes. And it's like 13 minutes of you crashing your car. So crashing happens a lot in your sport.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It really does. And I was always very grateful at the end of my career to be able to say that I was able to walk away from just about every accident pretty good.
Was that scary? Like, what do you feel like in one of those moments where, I mean, I've been in a few different car crashes, none of them super serious, but I've never gone into a spin on a turn at 200 miles an hour.
You're asking what goes through my mind?
Yeah. What does that feel like?
Well, usually you get an indication of something, you know, a lot of times, especially if it's a big wreck, you can kind of see stuff start to unfold and come, and you can almost feel like a concern come over you a little bit. I mean, you know, not every single time, especially if you're alone when it happens, but you know, as you can almost, it's actually, if there are other people involved, it's almost like I can feel the energy of the people around me. And the anxiety or the concern or the anxiousness or aggression or whatever it is. And you can kind of feel that coming. But the actual accident itself, aside from maybe a little bit of preemptive quantum energy I'm feeling, is that, you know, it starts and you think to yourself, oh shit. And then it goes kind of slow and you can kind of, the whole spin or the whole crashing or the whole thing unfolds in a way that allows you time to think, to navigate, to maybe turn away, to maybe, you know, let go of the steering wheel. Time slows down. So, you know, I don't know what, I mean, the whole theory of time and space are irrelevant, I think really applies in the situation of crashing, because when you watch it in real time, it didn't feel like the duration was the experience inside the car.
It's weird. Like our bodies are pretty good at like kind of intuitively knowing what to do. I mean, even like in your situation, it's not like evolutionarily we'd have some reason to survive a car crash, but your training kicks in, but then also your sort of self-preservation instincts kick in. So it's weird too, that we feel so much like fear and anxiety about stuff when really like our body kind of like in those moments like takes over and your opinion is like kind of irrelevant at that point.
Yeah. And meaning your opinion of what's going on or your opinion, what do you mean by your opinion?
I mean, like we worry, like, what am I going to do? Is it going to hurt? I'm afraid. And like, really then when you actually get in those moments, it's like, you know, people are like, what would I do in a fight? And it's like, your body takes over, like you're not really even consciously doing anything. And, or, you know, people are afraid of crashing on a bike, but it's like the thing happens so fast, but then your body kind of just takes over and handles what needs to do. You're not consciously doing anything in those moments.
And I also think that there's there's a disconnection from the physical pain or physical anything that happens to you physically, which is this weird sort of like mind space I get into. I remember talking to someone who was an anesthesiologist, and the idea of not having to numb someone before you do surgery, and they don't understand why.
Yes.
So it really makes you think, makes you wonder about what is truly going on between the body and the mind, and if pain is a real thing or if it's just a learned sort of subconscious programming that says, we crashed, it hurts. You know, I got cut open, I'm sore, right? As opposed to what's really going on, which is, I don't know. Going around on this idea of like, what is really happening? What is reality?
No, it's a great point because, you know, yeah, people are afraid that something's going to hurt, right? Like they're afraid that getting dumped will hurt. They're afraid that, you know, getting punched in the face will hurt, that hearing that someone you love died. And all those things do hurt. But when you tend to ask people what they felt in that moment, the answer is like, I didn't feel anything. I felt very calm. I felt nothing. Like, I remember I was a kid. We had this driveway and it was really steep. And I was riding down the driveway. No helmet, of course, on my bike. And the front wheel just literally fell off my bike. And so I hit, you know, the entire pavement like really fast, right on the right side of my face. And I remember getting up and going like, I'm fine. And I was not fine. You know, like I think I'd broken my eye socket and my lips were all caught on my braces. It was like one of the worst accidents I've ever been in. Yeah. And it didn't hurt until somebody showed me a mirror and they said, look at your face. That's actually my younger sister did this. And at that point, it started to become excruciatingly painful. But until I was like fully aware of what happened, my body was doing a pretty good job protecting me from the pain I was in.
Is it the body protecting you, or is it just a different reality than we comprehend?
That could be true. I mean, is that what you believe? You believe there's sort of these different realities that we inhibit?
I do. I think that so many things that we experience and the way that we take in an experience or something happening to us is learned.
And so we're often just following a pattern of how we think we should respond as opposed to how we need to respond.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that can be very true. I do think that the body sends you messages through feeling at times, but much more energetic quantum level. You know, like when someone walks into the room and you're like, oh, I get a weird vibe from that guy, you know?
Yeah.
That kind of stuff I think is sending us information, but I think a response is maybe something that's more programmed as opposed to, I don't know. It's a tricky thing. I suppose I think about the nature of reality a lot in my life and what's real and what's not and how much we create our reality. But it's an interesting thing to swirl around about.
You've lived a very surreal reality, right? Like you're one of the youngest, most successful race car drivers in history. You broke all these barriers. You're known all over the world. Do you think, I wonder part of it too, and I think you see this with artists, is because they live such a sort of untraditional life, it helps them see, you know, like the quirks in the matrix, so to speak. Like because your reality is so weird, it helps you question reality everywhere.
Yes, that's actually really insightful. I think that's true. And my example of that in a really silly example, as most of the time breaking theories open comes in really silly ways to me. Mm-hmm. But the one that comes to mind for that is that let's say you get popular, you go on a TV show, you go do an interview, you're in a magazine, you're on the cover, whatever it may be, you realize that it's driven by either a sponsor that is perhaps buying ads
Sure.
Whatever it is that you're being featured, or you're promoting something, you're promoting a race that you're doing, or like actors and actresses are promoting a movie that's coming out, a musician's promoting an album. So you realize that like there's so much more business behind. I realize that there's so much more business behind things, and like celebrities are kind of created a lot of times, as opposed to just, yes, they naturally happen for sure. But sort of the promotion and, you know, how much you see them is very much driven by lots of other factors. And it made me realize that the stuff that we see, the magazines we pick up and whatever, we just think, oh, they're famous. It's like, no, they're being made famous. Like somebody's paying for that, you know, somebody's making that happen. And so I think so early on, I realized, because I just realized that there was a lot of bullshit in there, and that there's an agenda behind everything. And so that was kind of the first crack in sort of the matrix of what's real and what's not as far as media goes, because I knew that I was being featured or put in certain positions because of things beyond me.
This is, I think, a very, very stoic idea. And what I'm, as I've become successful in my career, I think I've appreciated it more in meditations. Like Marcus Aurelius, when he's writing meditations, is the most famous man in the world. There's literally a cult of the emperor that's worshiping him as a god. There's statues all over him wherever he goes. There's parades. And he writes in meditations all the time. You can tell he's trying to sort of sober himself. And like one of my favorite scenes, he's like, clearly at this banquet being thrown in his honor, and he sort of breaks it down. He's like, you know, this is a dead pig, and you know, this is a dead bird, and this wine is fermented grapes, and he, like, only the emperor was supposed to wear a purple cloak. And so he's talking about how his purple cloak is exactly the same as everyone else's cloak. It's just dyed with shellfish blood. And then he goes through and talks about how the purple dye is created. And I think he's doing what you're talking about, which is if you peek behind the curtain, that can have it should have the effect of making you realize that what's going on back there is not as special as you think it is. And if you don't have that reaction, then being on the cover of the magazine is going to fuel your ego and your self-importance, probably in an unhealthy way.
That is the next question that I was going to ask, is what are the repercussions of that?
Yeah, I mean, my favorite thing is he talks about posthumous fame, which is kind of the thing that I think a lot of people who are successful and ambitious, you're like, I want to be known. I want to have this or that. And, you know, you want to be on a magazine cover, you want to sell books or something. And then, you know, there's this, you go, but what would really, like, are people going to remember this? And so we're kind of driven by like, it's not just cool to be famous. You have to be like, famous for all of eternity. Like, that's really impressive. And his point, he just talks about, he's like, you're going to be dead, so what do you care? And his point is like, also the people who are going to be alive in the future are going to be just as annoying as the people who are alive right now. It's not really any more special to be famous 200 years after your death as it is to be famous right now.
That leads me, it's like taking a turn a little bit, but it's something that I was going to ask you about when I interviewed you, but we didn't get to. And that's that, you know, you're obviously, you know, wise beyond your years. We're talking, you're referencing people that were seemingly wise beyond their years. So I have this idea that civilization or culture is progressing in a linear way towards an expanding consciousness and awareness. But in the whole span of time, there have been people that have come in that have spiked to a very high level beyond where we even are now, that are here to show us the way. And I wonder if you think that's true, you know, whether it be Marcus Aurelius or Jesus or yourself or Alan Watts or, you know, someone like that, you know, Terrence McKenna, you know, are these people like, do you feel like in all of time, it's not that we get delivered these really ancient souls that come here to teach us things?
I do believe that. I mean, I certainly don't believe that I'm on, you know, in that company, but I believe that there, I believe in energy sort of like you're talking about. And it seems like there are every several generations, there seems to be someone who's kind of tapped into an energy or reached into a place of sort of deeper consciousness that allows them to, you know, do something really magical. And, you know, what I am fascinated with is the Stoics is that Jesus and Seneca are born in the same year in the same Roman Empire and are talking about a lot of the same things. So I don't think it only has to be from a religious context. I just think there's, we do have the ability to sort of have kind of a fleeting impact like that. And I'm like, you know, there's this, it's sort of not trendy to believe now in what they call the great man of history theory, which is that like an individual can change history. But I actually like sort of profoundly believe in that. And I think it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you don't think that a person can make a difference like that, then you're not going to be that person.
So true.
I want to go back to the death thing. I'm curious. So obviously it makes sense why when you're getting in the car, you can't be thinking about, you know, I'm going to crash. This is so scary. I could get hurt. But did doing such a dangerous sport in which I'm sure you knew racers who lost their lives or you were at races where that happened, how did that shape your life off the track? Like, did it make you more present or did it make you, you know, more reckless? Like, how did you think about, like, I got to imagine, like, if you're a police officer or you're in the army, knowing that there is a, that every day there's a risk that you could get shot or hurt, or firemen, knowing that risk probably changes, I don't know, like how you are over breakfast in the morning.
No, that's the answer.
It didn't.
I mean, I was at the track when people died a couple times and knew them obviously because I was driving in the same race. Or, you know, I remember the most vivid one was, it was the beginning of the 2006 season and we were at Homestead Miami Speedway. And back then we used to do a morning warm-up before the race. And so we were all out in the morning warm-up and somebody had an issue and a car came around and hit him. And anyway, this was my teammate and he died. And, we no longer did morning warm-ups after that, but I remember that what I felt was that I was sorry for my family and loved ones that I would have absolutely gone out that day and raced. Like I had no problem with that. And I felt sort of guilty to, I felt selfish in a way that I didn't feel it on a level that made me concerned for other people. Like that I was selfish enough to say, you know, I could still go out there and drive. We, as a team, our team owner sat, my other, there was three of us and the other two drivers, myself and another, we didn't race that day as a sort of respect to him, of course. And I just remember feeling like I would have gone out that day. And so even if I track all the way back to my, probably, my, I think it was the first time I flipped a go-kart. I was racing at Charlotte Motor Speedway inside of the big track. So there was a little go-kart track in there. So I was racing go-karts and I was probably like 14. And it was one lap to go and I was leading and I went into the first corner of the last lap and it was a road course. So it went left and right and everything didn't just go in a circle. So I got bumped out of the way and two guys got by me and I followed them all, you know, caught back up and came around to the very last corner of that lap. And we all spread out wide and went into the last corner and the carts in front of me lifted and I didn't. And so I drove over the back of the go-kart. And in fact, the person that I drove over ended up, I mean, he drove Indy cars. He won the Indy 500. His name is Sam Hornish. And I drove over him and there's pictures of it and everything, and then landed on my head, flipped over, and my dad came running out, and I think he barrel rolled himself. He's like, my legs were not working as fast as my brain. So he got out there. But I remember after that whole accident happened, aside from the fact that I never wore blue race shoes again after that day, because I think that was the first weekend with blue race shoes. Oh, the superstitions. I remember my dad telling me, you're not invincible. Like, you can get hurt. This is you're not bulletproof. And obviously, I don't really remember how I was acting, but I was obviously acting in some kind of a way that I was somewhat unaffected or even angry or motivated by it. And so, you know, that's kind of a couple of stories of a long-winded answer of how do I do when there's danger and death and all that around me. And that's it, that it, again, it's probably keeping my bridge low and not acknowledging the depth of danger.
Well, it's like some horses have to be prodded and then other horses have to be reined in, right? So some people probably have to work themselves up to do a scary thing. And it may be that your personality, your biology, your experiences, you have to like sort of keep maybe that drive in check a little bit to get to the same middle ground, which is like not being too afraid, but also not being too fearless.
Mm. Yeah, I would definitely say that my personality is that of speed. I know it sounds so cliche.
Or intensity.
But it's speed. It's about I do everything quickly, so I kind of rush into things, and so I'm used to working on instinct, intuition, and not on processing and thinking. That's not really the place that I go. So now in my older age, I'm trying to pair feeling with thinking, right? Taking enough time to slow down and think about things and then acknowledging how that sits in my body as a feeling. So I feel like in my age, I'm trying to marry the two of them.
Hey, it's Ryan. Got a quick message from one of our sponsors, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned. I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
No, I get that for sure. I think especially if you're really good at something, one of the ways you can get away with not having to think or deal with anything uncomfortable or, you know, not in your control is just to go do your thing. You know, like for me, like life is complicated, but writing is very simple. I mean, writing is hard and it's complex in other ways, but it's like, it exists. It's just me and the computer screen, but like calling customer service to get something figured out is actually much harder for me and more stressful than like writing a book. Do you know what I mean? And so I got to imagine as racing goes away, you're forced to feel and deal with more things.
Yeah. Yeah. Why do you think that is?
Why is it more difficult?
Yeah.
Well, I think you get, you know, you can get really lopsided, right? It's like if you're only working out one arm all the time, it's going to get really strong and then the other arm is going to atrophy. So I think, you know, one of the blessings and curses of being good at something, particularly a thing that makes other people money, is that people kind of swoop in and take stuff off your plate. It's like the NBA player that like flies, has to go to the airport after they retire and nobody is like escorting them and booking their ticket. And you know what I mean? Like suddenly you're like back to reality.
So is it just about a familiarity then?
I mean, I think that's part of it, but I also think it's like, it's basically and I've struggled with this, I've written about it, but like work and activity are just as addictive as sex or drugs or alcohol or any other, or you know, eating. We can cope with inner pain or anguish or feelings of inadequacy or whatever your issue is. You can cope with them by doing anything that rewards you with endorphins. And so, you know, like if I'm not careful, work can consume my life and then I don't have to deal with any of my shit. So I've got to imagine that retiring, especially, you know, like what's interesting for me about athletes is how young, you know, like it's like you're done and you're good, you know, like, and obviously you're still going to do other stuff and you have your podcast and you do TV and whatever. But I just mean like it no longer is your life exclusively dedicated to one thing. I got to imagine a bunch of stuff comes up.
Emotionally, you mean?
Yeah, emotionally, personally, just, yeah, like all of a sudden things that you've been putting off are now there and either you make yourself busy so you don't have to deal with them or you decide to deal with them.
I agree. I mean, to me, it's just because I haven't practiced them. Like I'm not, you know, you've probably practiced writing a lot,
yeah.
Right? You don't, sure. You don't practice calling customer service. Nobody really likes doing that. So we don't, you know, I think that what, so yeah, when I was racing, it was very automatic, very, and you know, dare I say, it wasn't easy. It was always very, it was easy to do and hard to be really good at. I don't know if that resonates, but
sure.
You know, there's sort of like a push that has to happen to keep on excelling, but just doing the job itself was easy. Like driving was easy, but I practiced a lot. And so I guess, you know, when you step away or have more time outside of whatever it is that you did a lot, you're having to kind of go through the growing pains. And so, you know, I think that, I mean, stuff that pops up emotionally, I think is really just, I think it's aside from a new activity or a new discipline. I think that's just a matter of wanting, growing as a human being and expanding and wanting more for yourself. And so again, just kind of like learning a new activity, you have to learn how to feel and you have to learn how to cope with emotions and you have to learn how to communicate and learn how to not project and learn how to discover your triggers. And there's a lot of learning that goes on because it's not something that, you know, it's you want more peace, you want more joy, you want more happiness. And so you have to kind of disarm some of those things that block you from it. And so that's just like a separate learning. But I think that it's similar in its nature that it's hard because And you kind of don't want to do it either, because we just kind of tend to like to do things that we're really good at and that are easy. because I have this theory that human nature is to do the minimum, but everyone's minimum is different. So if you've come from a family that's like really hard and pushes you, and like your minimum's pretty damn high. But if you come from a family that, you know, like, you know, there's no accountability and you can do whatever you want now, and you're, you know, maybe it's a wealthy family, your minimum becomes kind of low. So, but you know, it's what is your minimum? What do you require of yourself? How good do you want to be? How evolved do you want to get? And then that determines just how much challenge there's going to be in getting there.
To me, that's the critical question. Cause you said a couple of times, like you have to. I think you can. I would argue most people don't, right? So like there are plenty of athletes, for instance, that retire and then just immediately throw themselves into something else. So they never actually do have to do that. And like I see every time I finish a book, I'm like, oh, I'm going to take a break. But I don't, you know, like there's certainly a part of, there's a tempting part to just, and this is what I was talking about in my stillness book. There's a part that just wants to keep going, so you don't have to do those uncomfortable things you're talking about.
What is it that you're avoiding?
I mean, I think at the end of the day, what most of us are avoiding is just having to be with ourselves. There's a Blaise Pascal line. He says, "All of humanity's problems stem from our inability to sit quietly in a room alone." I think, like at the core of it, you know, there's pain or fear or uncertainty or questions that we all have about life, about meaning, about, you know, feelings that we have or urges that we have or whatever it is. And, you know, work, drugs are a fun way to not have to do with those things. And if you can get away with them not being addictive, you know, it can be cool. But work and activity is the most socially accepted way to run from your problems and the way that's rewarded the most.
Mm-hmm. What's the thing that you're the most proud of yourself for sitting through and getting quiet enough to really deal with?
I mean, I think having kids forced me to do a lot of those things, like realizing I was like very closed off emotionally, you know, realizing that I had sort of a lot of pain from my childhood that I had, you know, sort of that maybe my, you know, my relationship with my parents wasn't the way that I thought it was, mm-hmm. that there was, you know, and one of the, I think, you know, I'm fascinated by sort of some inner child work. Like how do you really go? Cause I feel like a lot of us are sort of stuck at a certain age. And mm-hmm. for some of us, that age is 5 and some of us that age is 15 or whatever it is, but whenever something happened to you, you can kind of get stuck in that age, or that's like the maturity you get to. And so I think one of the things that having kids does is sort of this perpetual reminder of it is that it's like, I don't really remember what it was like to be 4, and I don't spend a lot of time with 4-year-olds, but now that I have a 4-year-old, you're like, oh, I was like this. And knowing what I know about my parents, or knowing what I know about where I grew up, or, you know, whatever it is, you kind of are re-experiencing your childhood. And so I think the last few years I've been trying to wrestle with just like all of those issues. And it's been painful and hard, but I think ultimately good. And I think if you do the work, it makes you better at what you do professionally. There's like a great Judd Apatow quote where he talks about realizing that the movie studio was not his parents, and that he could just interact with them as like work partners. He didn't have to like project all his childhood issues at the studio executive who was trying to tell him that the movie was too long. So I have a lot of that.
I agree. This is stuff that I've been dealing with. This is kind of, you're encompassing the last like 4 months of my life. No, 6 months of my life, I'd say. Unpacking what happened to me in childhood. And this sounds so aggressive. As a parent, I'm sure, like, I know I offended my parents because I addressed a lot of these things this summer with them. And so when you say the word trauma, it's like such a, they feel so attacked. And but it's more about just like you said, being stuck at an age. Trauma is just recognizing that there was an event that happened that was a big enough deal that you created an emotional feeling as a result of it, and you got stuck there. So that sort of situation, when it comes up in a new form, new people, new players, when it happens, you go right back to the age that it happened. The original yes. feeling, and you're stuck there, whatever age that is. So I guess depending on how somebody acts in a situation, how they respond, how they're triggered, will probably give you somewhat of an indication of their trauma age. And of course we have, you know, more than one trauma. It's not like you just get one. I mean, wouldn't that be great if we only had one trauma to deal with?
Right.
But, you know, you can definitely kind of identify a little bit of like, wow, they acted like a toddler. And you're like, well, it probably happened when they were four, you know?
Totally. And I think it's also, I think a lot of people go like, well, I wasn't abused, you know, I wasn't an orphan, you know, like just because your life wasn't an episode of the TV show Intervention, you know, right. doesn't mean that you didn't experience, that you got everything you needed and you're a perfectly well-adjusted adult human being.
And in some ways, I think that it's okay. Now, I wouldn't want this for myself. I'm grateful for my life and I have great parents, but in some ways I've thought about this, and that if you have an identifiable trauma, like a really big one, not just like an emotional trauma, meaning something happened that you remember and get triggered from, but like a real, like big one, yeah. whether it be, you know, abuse or rape or alcoholism or, you know, being adopted, or it's like, it takes a lot longer to unpack it because you think everything's okay. You don't yes. think that there's a problem. So there's the only blessing to the bigger things that happen to someone in their life is that they recognize very quickly, hopefully, that you need to deal with it. Like, you know what I mean? Like you go, well, I had a really shitty childhood. I wouldn't say that. I didn't have a shitty childhood. I had a great childhood, but it doesn't mean there weren't things that happened that are not holding me back now. And so I've thought about that a lot, and that, you know, the only little blessing in the big stuff is that you know to address it a lot sooner, and it perhaps becomes a proactive thing as opposed to a reactive thing where, you know, maybe you have to have quite a pattern established for you to recognize, I think I might need to deal with this. I keep the common denominator.
No, I think that's right. Yeah. Like when you have something that sort of rises to the level of objective or externally, you know, recognizable, it becomes clear. Like, yeah, look, you should go to therapy because your dad was an alcoholic, or you should go to therapy because, you know, you lost your leg in an accident and that was very traumatic. But if it can be almost more disorienting for everything to sort of seem normal and good on the surface, and then there's actually these other things that are happening or that you don't understand, and then you can kind of, your mind convinces you everything is normal and good, and you don't realize that, hey, actually, you picked up some bad habits or bad patterns, or you made, you know, some bad assumptions about the world. And then now as you get older or more successful, these kind of scripts that you have aren't working.
Mm. So I'm going to share what kind of came through for me today
in
between my meditation and sort of my active physical, emotional, verbal, like, because there's a lot of you make a lot of noises and things like that and get energy moving. So what came through today is that, you know, I've been trying to kind of break away from being able to be more detached and to be more of an observer and to, you know, sort of find this middle ground for myself that isn't so aggressive, or like I have this sort of, I can sense people's truth in a way, and I can I don't know where it comes from. So sometimes I kind of stab him in the heart with truth, even though it's love like, and, but it comes in a really, really, like an aggressive way. And, you know, being able to get to more of that sort of softer, balanced heart space of love, but yet still being able to hold truth. And what came through was that, like, that I am this sort of like, you know, lovely sort of wonderful being who has been wrapped in this purposeful, as in it's served a purpose, package that's got me a lot in life. Like, it's gotten me a lot in life to be so aggressive and so strong and so down the barrel. And so the fact that I can do that means I can take that. You know, we don't usually deliver more than we can accept. So I was like, today I realized, I'm like, oh my God, it's not that it's just that I'm evolving and it doesn't serve me anymore. And so maybe we don't look at these traumas because look, like people have written beautiful music from trauma. People have, you know, written great books from trauma. And so instead of looking at maybe all the things that have happened and going, oh, we need to get rid of that. And that's horrible. And I just want to be healed. And maybe looking at it of like, just like evolving and like, and just growing and getting past, like just becoming a new version of yourself that serves where you are now, whether it be emotionally or frequency wise or just something that you want. Because that's what I felt today is I was like, I thank that part of me that was built that way based on my family and based on my situation and based on my job and all of those things that conditioned me in this way that I'm just not happy with anymore. And I'm grateful for the things that it gave me. So I guess it's this idea that maybe, you know, instead of thinking that we need to get, you know, we need to heal these traumas. Yes, well, it's not really, it's yes, it's heal, but it's acknowledging them and saying thank you and understanding that they just don't serve anymore and allowing a new phase to come in that is just something that you want more.
There's a great book you might like called Lincoln's Melancholy, and it's all about Abraham Lincoln's sort of lifelong struggle with depression. And how it's sort of along the lines of what you're talking about. It's depression isn't this thing that you win against. It's not like a fight. It just, he sort of realizes ultimately that this was giving him a perspective and the pain of it and the struggle with it through his life was actually sort of shaping him into being the person that he had to be at this very essential moment in world history. And so I think like, yeah, you can fight against all these things and be angry and bitter that, you know, it's so-and-so's fault or that if this had happened otherwise, but that doesn't give you anything to move forward with. I think you have to go like, hey, this is like, you know, my therapist said this to me one time and was like, look, this is the hand you were dealt. Like you got to play it, you know, and you got to figure out what you're going to do about it. That doesn't mean you have to be stuck that way forever, but you do have to sort of figure out how you're going to work with it.
My therapist told me the thing that hit really hard because it proved to me let me say what she said first. She said, they don't hold any keys for you. And so before she said that, I kept thinking like, we need to work through this together. We're going to talk about this. They're going to say sorry for things. They're going to acknowledge, they're going to inform me. We're going to do this together in a way. And she goes, they don't hold any keys for you. And I was like, whoa, I got kind of emotional. And I was like, that's a lot to handle because that means that I am accountable, fully accountable.
Yeah.
And
sure.
So that's, I think, the biggest, I would say, probably the biggest reason why we tend to sort of not be able to let go of things is because we can't recognize our true and complete accountability to get past them because it's really hard. It's like really hard to understand how to unpack and like acknowledge even the like nuances of it and how it shows up in your life. And so accountability is to me what it screamed. And I was like, whoa. And again, that goes back to almost where we started with this whole diatribe of thoughts, is that with that accountability is like, you know, it's what we started talking about in the beginning.
Yeah. No, look, you can be angry that you're mortal, and you could be angry that life is short, or, you know, that people die and that you lose people and all of that, but it doesn't change it. And so, yeah, there's a great Cheryl Strayed line where she's like, it's not your fault, but it is your problem. And I try to think about a lot of these things that way too. Like, it is indifferent to your opinion about it. So you better figure out a good way to come to terms with it.
Exactly. That's so true. It's not your fault, but it is your responsibility.
Yeah. No, and the only way you get through life is by taking responsibility for stuff.
Mm-hmm. What's the hardest thing that you feel like you've had to take responsibility for?
Oh man, that's a good one. I don't know. I feel fortunate that I don't have, like, you know, it's like, oh, I'm taking responsibility for that person I killed in a drunk driving accident or something, right? Like, I don't have any, like, you know, like, horrible truth that I have to accept. But I'm constantly trying to look back at who I am and decisions I've made and things that I've written and paths that I've gone down, and sort of going, like, why did I do that? What was motivating me? You know, you can't change the stuff that you've done, but you do, you know, provided it's not sort of like criminally illegal or something, you can decide to not do it anymore. And you can decide to not be that person anymore. And I think that's where self-improvement comes from.
What is your perspective on regret?
You know, I get that a lot, because my first book was this sort of controversial media book. And I, you know, I did a bunch of stuff that maybe at the time I thought was hilarious, and in retrospect, you know, not super proud of. But people sort of go like, do you regret it? And it's like, I don't regret it. I just disagree with it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't sit there and like weep for what I've done, because it wasn't really at that level either. But I also, you know, don't see that as a particularly productive emotion. So I you know what I mean? I think you just grow from it. And I'm sure you have decisions in your career where, like, if you were doing it again, you'd absolutely do it otherwise. And you now make that decision differently going forward. But, like, I would hope you're not, like, crippled by what ifs and what could have been.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel very, very much like you feel about that. I'm just backing up whatever I'm going to say. I'm just curious about this first. Are you someone that I have a theory that people tend to either live in the future or live in the past. Like, the present's what we want, but we either tend to be someone that sort of future forecasts and, you know, thinks about everything that they want to happen and gets attached to the outcomes, or you're somebody who's pulled back by the past and, you know, sort of the memories paralyze you at times to things because of what you learned from what you were taught by an old memory. And so are you future or past?
It's weird. I feel like I love the past, like, mm-hmm. in that I love history. So I'm like mm-hmm. obsessed with the past, but I'm not that interested in my past. So I feel like I am much more a living in the future, but I do feel like I do a pretty good job, like, being very tied to what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm. That's very.
What about you?
I'm a future person. I'm a future thinker. I don't have regrets. Like, there are things that I, like you said, I wish I'd maybe done differently, or like, oh man, that was a bummer. But I also recognize, like, you know, sliding doors or the butterfly effect, like, everything that's happened in my life has led me to here. So if I changed one little thing, I might not be here right now. And I am happy to be here right now. And so I think too that, you know, we got to learn lessons along the way. And so, you know, we tend to not learn things the easy way. We tend to learn a lot of things the hard way. Maybe even everything, because everybody at the beginning kind of sucks at something, right? You're not that great at it when you start, sure. No matter what it is. So I don't wish I could go back in time and change anything. So to me, that means that I don't have regrets. Doesn't mean I don't have disappointments or,
sure,
you know, things like that. But yeah, I'm very much a future forecaster, future thinker, which is kind of where I get, you know, a little bit more attached to outcomes and, you know, tend to force things because I'm still gripping, like I'm still like reaching for the future. So I don't want those dreams to die. I'm a very hard worker and I'm very determined and I have a lot of endurance. So I tend to do things, stick with something or someone or a job or anything like that a little longer maybe than I need to, or I'm not as honest about it as early as I need to be because I am sort of determined to make it right.
No, I totally relate to that. And I think that that's probably a good place to wrap, right? Which is that the point of being present is that it really is all you have, right? So the past is done, but then the future is inherently uncertain. And whether you're racing cars or, you know, just walking down the street or, you know, living in the middle of a pandemic, like something could get you at any moment. And the Stoics talk about that, I think, not to scare you, but to give you the gift of the present moment and the understanding, like, do not waste this regretting or dreaming because, like, now is now.
And what gives it meaning is mortality.
Of course. Yes. Right. No, it would be, the curse of Sisyphus is that he has to roll this boulder up and down a hill and forever.
Oh, that sounds awful.
Well, thank you so much. It was amazing to talk to you. And I'm really excited that we met.
You're welcome. It was really, really nice to chat. I very much enjoyed talking to you and hearing your perspective. And thank you for all the philosophizing that you shared. And I love to read it and do it with you. So
amazing.
Thank you for the chance.
If you like the podcast that we do here and you want to get it via email every morning, you can sign up at dailystoic.com/email. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.